What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Deep in the imagination, there's a crossroads, a space where curiosity and inspiration intersect and give birth to ideas. A space where music, science fiction, comic books, and pop culture inform the mind of what is and what could be. This is Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. In each episode, legendary journalist Jeff Boucher welcomes the biggest names in genre entertainment for an expansive dive into all things pop culture. Journey with Jeff as he explores the latest news and recommendations of the hottest releases across entertainment with his most trusted confidants. You are now entering deep space. Heavy Metal presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space.
Welcome to Mind Space. This is Jeff. How you doing, Evan?
Good, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy Halloween almost.
Yeah, and we're going to continue that month with another great Halloween guest, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's right. It's all about the horror today. We have Steve Niles, who is one of my favorite guys in the comics industry, and he's a real specialist, you know? A lot of people in comics that write or draw comics are specialists in superheroes, like quite a few of them are, but Steve is a specialist in horror, which you don't necessarily see quite as often.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his bibliography is insane. You know, he worked on a Night of the Living Dead comic, an I Am Legend comic. He worked on and then his big first comic he did solo was 30 Days a Night with Ben Temple Smith. And then he has my favorite series of his, which is Criminal Macabre, which he also did with Ben Temple Smith. And it just, I mean, the list just keeps going. I mean, he Freaks of the Heartland, 28 Days Later, The Aftermath. It just keeps going, going, going. And he's like a true fan of horror, too.
Yeah, exactly. He's a real connoisseur. He loves like the classic horror, you know, the Universal monsters, especially Frankenstein's monster. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Boris Karloff image and the ways that that's echoed through popular culture. And I first became aware of Steve. I think Darwin Cook actually might have introduced us. But my first thing I was aware of that he did was 30 Days a Night, which was that. It was executed extremely well. It's a story about vampires having a big feast. But the real kind of allure of the story is this idea that Steve had about, wow, if you're a vampire and you can't go out during the daytime, why not take advantage of that 30 days of night that they have up in Alaska?
Yeah.
So it's just one of those great, like, kernel of an idea that as soon as you hear it, you know it's going to be good. I thought it was really great to get it in the title too, like with like really, really savvy and it seemed organic as well. But that and Criminal Macabre and a lot of the horror stuff. So we're going to talk to Steve today about those things and about Bernie Wrightson. I don't know how much you know about Bernie Wrightson, Evan.
Do
you
know? I don't know much about him, I have to say.
Yeah, he's a towering figure to people that grew up reading comics in the 60s and 70s. I grew up, you know, the first comics I saw were in the 70s, you know, like 74, 75, when I was like 3 or 4 years old. And Bernie Wrightson, you know, he was co-creator of Swamp Thing, and he did all the horror, he did a lot of horror stuff. He was super famous for doing this horror, kind of the gothic, traditional House of Secrets, House of Mystery, you know, kind of classic high horror, but not limited to that. And he could do anything. He also was the artist, Bernie Wrightson, on The Cult, which is a real landmark miniseries with Batman in the 1980s. And he's just a tremendous, tremendous talent. He's known for his very intricate line work and his very kind of evocative horror imagery. And we lost Bernie a few years back, so we're going to talk to Steve about this guy who is just one of he's a talent. You know, it's like Neil Adams, Jim Steranko, Bernie Wrightson. He's like that level. You know, he's right up there with the titans of the whose career started in the 60s, those guys. And he came a little later than like Frazetta and obviously later than Kirby or Eisner or any of those guys who started in the golden age.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking to Steve. And, you know, he showed us a little bit about of his Frankenstein collection, which I thought was really cool. You know, he has like all these different like toys and posters and artwork of Frankenstein, the Boris Karloff one. It's very, very cool. So he'll talk a little bit about that as well. Before we get to his interview, you know, we have a little bit of news to discuss, which I'm sure you're already aware, but unfortunately, many, many movies that were coming out soon and then a little bit next year have been pushed, let's say indefinitely, because 2022 doesn't even seem like a real year.
It's a lot of twos for 1 year.
Yeah.
There's a two, and then there's a zero, and then there's two more twos. So that's quite a few twos. Yeah, they're going to have to change all those signs to coming not so soon. Coming not so soon. You know, everybody wants their movies out, and everybody wants their movies to be seen and successful. But of course, everybody's worried that the timing isn't going to be on their side. And with everything that everybody's dealing with in the world right now, go figure. Of course, it's going to. I'm surprised that we're not even already talking about 2023.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, we had talked about Dune a little bit a couple weeks ago. That got pushed to 2021. Right. The Batman's getting pushed to 2022. The list goes on and on and on. You know, the new Matrix getting pushed, Spider-Man's getting pushed. It's unfortunate, you know.
It's a shame. But it's where we're at, so I don't think anybody's really surprised.
Yeah, that's true.
At this point.
But on the good side of movies, they've announced that they're rebooting the Resident Evil franchise, and I thought that was interesting.
Did you say President Evil? Is that what you just said?
No. But I think that movie could do very well right now. I'm talking about the Resident Evil series based on the video game. I think it did like 6 or 7 movies.
I think so. And with Mila Jovovich, and I hope I'm saying that right. And she, if I'm not mistaken, she became the first. She became the first Hollywood star to be an actress featured in a franchise that had gone north of 4 installments, I believe. That's kind of a mouthful there. I think she became the first woman to be the headline star of a multi-film franchise that exceeded 4 or 5 installments.
Does that make sense? Yeah, no, it definitely does.
Yeah, and Sigourney Weaver, you know, like with Aliens, she would be right up there. You know, Terminator doesn't really kind of qualify because Linda Hamilton's only been in a few of them. You know,
so, yeah, that's true.
You know, Charlize Theron and Zoe Saldana. You know, there's a lot of
Uma Thurman.
Yeah, there's a lot of sci-fi, fantasy, action actresses who have a lot of movies, but none that are in one franchise all strung together like that, though. So. I expect that she's probably not going to be in this one though, probably, right?
No, I think it's like a complete reboot. You know, they announced some of the cast. It's like Robbie Amell. I don't know if you've seen, my favorite thing that he's in is the Babysitter series that's on Netflix. He's hilarious in that, but that's probably not what he's best known for.
He's in the Download thing.
Upload,
forgive me. Yeah, I've watched a few episodes of that. He's in that. And I know his brother from Arrow.
Yeah. And then Tom Hopper, who plays number one in Umbrella Academy, is going to be in it.
Yeah. So that's a whole fresh start.
Yeah.
There's not very many video game franchises on the film side. You know, they don't seem to endure. I mean, we've had Lara Croft, you know, a couple of bites of that apple, trying to make that work and with some success. But you look at the video game, there's not a lot of great video games based on movies, and there's not a lot of great movies based on video games. I mean,
True. I think you're right. I think Resident Evil is probably the one that has had success on both sides.
Yeah, you know, you just don't really see a ton of video game adaptations. You get things like Max Payne, you remember? I mean, that was a big deal, but then it wasn't, you know?
It was nothing. I think that was kind of like comic books, the movie was almost nothing like the video game. And so I think people were kind of confused. You know, they kind of added like like demons or something to the movie with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah. Weird. There's all kinds of stuff. And you know, you look at when they do like a World of Warcraft movie and you're like, well, why? Like, you know, what's how does that work? Like, because, or Dungeons and Dragons, you know, they're trying to do another Dungeons and Dragons movie. But the thing is there is no Dungeons and Dragons story. That's the whole point about Dungeons and Dragons. It's whatever happens to your, you know, each adventure is a unique and, you know, kind of, it's not that rigid. It's not like Lord of the Rings where it's a very familiar arc, story arc that you're going to follow. You know, what character is at the central, is the central character in Dungeons and Dragons movie? You know, there is none, you know, because it's just not the way it's built.
Yeah, that's very true. And then a lot of people make their own quests in Dungeons and Dragons. So you're right, there's not really like any big characters that people can be looking forward to.
Yeah, it's not like a familiar story or, you know, a kind of a even recognizable structure of a story that that is going to pull people in the way like a Harry Potter or a Lord of the Rings, where, you know, there's a hero's journey that's familiar to everyone.
Yeah, so, that's very true.
Yeah, but it's sort of interesting that it's not worked. And it's also interesting that there's not really great video games that are based on movies, because a lot of the movie adaptations that hit the video game shelves, you know, seem like afterthoughts, or they just don't seem to kind of grab the imagination. It's probably the way that they're made, because of all the things that have to be done. There's so much of a lead time necessary to make a game and to make a movie. So these things are happening contemporaneously, but they don't interact in an organic way. I mean, they're kept separate, so each of them is probably stifled in a way.
Yeah, I think part of it too is when you're playing a video game, generally it's you're having your own experience with the game. And then it's completely your own. But then when it comes onto, you know, a movie screen, it feels less like your own experience and more like a group experience. And so they might be having things in the movie that like you didn't feel when you were playing the game yourself.
Yeah.
One exception to that is a great film that I will recommend, which is Doom. It was in 2005. It had Carl Urban, Dwayne Johnson, and Rosamund Pike.
Wow.
It's it's just a fun movie. I mean, you know, it's not taking itself very seriously, but it's just a fun movie, and it's based off of the old video game Doom, so, which has now actually had its own resurgence. So,
Yeah, check that out. You know, I have not seen that. I remember the big video game thing that I remember going to was Prince of Persia. You know, the Jerry Bruckheimer movie, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, and starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Ben Kingsley. And I remember going to interview Jake for that on stage up in WonderCon, you know, before it was done, previewing it, and everybody was real excited about it. And then months later, going to the premiere and seeing the movie, and I took my son, and he was at the time, I want to say he was maybe 9 or 10. And we watched the movie, and then we go to the little after party, and there's Jake Gyllenhaal, and there's Ben Kingsley, and then there's Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer of you know, so many movies, Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, for instance. And he sees me, and he sees my son, and he walks over to us, and he says hi to me, and then he kind of kneels down, gets down on his haunches to be eye to eye with my son, who's kind of just kind of looking around, taking it all in. And Jerry says, "Hi. So what do you think of Prince of Persia?" And my son looks at him and goes, and he holds his hand out flat, like you would if you were showing somebody how tall something was. Mm-hmm. And then he wags his hand up and down like it's
like so-so.
Yeah, exactly. He goes, "Eh."
Oh my gosh. I bet you just broke into a cold sweat.
Well, you know what? What are you going to do, right? It's not what I would have said, but it's I understood it. And also, I got to give my son credit, because I think when I was that age, if a grown-up said to me, "What do you think?" I'd be like, "Sure, I loved it." You know, like, I just go with it. I mean, especially if you're at a party with free food and it says Prince of Persia everywhere. You know, there's all these people. There's people dressed like the Prince of Persia all around you. It's like a carnival. And he's like, "Nah, I'm not feeling it." Yeah, I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what he said. And then, to his credit, Jerry Bruckheimer, he nodded and he goes, "I know."
That is such a great story. Man, I wonder if your son is the youngest critic of Jerry Bruckheimer that he's ever met. You know,
I guarantee you that's happened to everybody who's ever asked a lot of kids about movies is you're going to get one who's just going to tell you the truth, you know, like every once in a while. But I just thought that was great. And I love the way that Jerry did it. He goes, yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's a great way to take it, man. That's a great story.
Yeah.
But we have Steve Niles waiting, and we can keep talking. Yeah, we could keep talking about these stories all day, but let's get to the interview unless you have anything else.
Nope, that's it. And that's it. My son's name is Ben, by the way, so I should make sure I give him credit for if I'm going to tell that whole story. So,
shout out to Ben.
The youngest film critic in the world, Ben Boucher. So, but yeah, that sounds great. Let's talk to Steve.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was horror. It's like such an interesting time for horror across all of pop culture. In film, it's really interesting. It's interesting in books. It's interesting in comics, television. But I'm wondering about the nature of horror when we live in a world where, you know, you look out the door and it might have more complications than the novel you're reading.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of my favorite things about horror is that it is confronting your fears. Mm. You know, even when it's fun, you know, I mean, it's still like, you know, it's like a roller coaster. You get on it willingly, knowing you're going to get the crap scared out of you. And I really think you work things through that way. I think, you know, you do wind up confronting your fears. And so I think, you know, in times like this, people need it. People need the release. And it's better that they get it through fiction, you know, then we're getting enough of it in real life.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, for sure. You know, the interesting thing about the way we're trained as either readers or as audience members, we get used to the way stories are told, the way they're crafted. And I find myself with the pandemic being fascinated by the little details of how it affects everyday life. And they strike me as if a novelist has put this together. I'm like, oh, the thing with the masks, that's really good. I wouldn't have thought of that. You know, like all the little details that we pick up through being cultured by it.
Yeah, it's very strange because I notice now when I'm watching a movie or TV or whatever, you know, I'm watching stuff made years ago, obviously, but I'm still like, oh my God, they're talking so close. Why aren't they wearing masks? You know? And it's creeping into my writing too, because I'm writing stuff now that I'm hoping will come out when all this is over.
Right.
So I'm trying to do things normally. You know, I'm just having normal, no masks. I'm not acknowledging COVID or anything like that. And it's so odd because I feel like I'm doing something wrong.
I guess that's a testament to how adaptable we are, because the new normal, as they say, how quickly it becomes the rigid thing that we're expecting, you know, like it's hard to think the way things were just a few months ago.
Just 3 months ago. I know. Yeah. 3 months ago, everything was completely normal. And now, you know, I'm wearing a mask all the time. You know, we're a little lucky because I'm out in the middle of nowhere. I'm really cut off from people.
Right.
You know, I've got acres between me and any neighbors or anything. So I feel a little more protected, but boy, when I go out, you know, I really feel it.
Sure. Now, you know, I think the first thing that I read by you, if I remember right, was 30 Days of Night. And it immediately struck me, the ingenuity of it, the kind of like, wow, what a great idea. You know, just the one sentence of it just jumps off the page. How did that one come to you? Was that one that was a thunderbolt, or is that chiseling?
I had it for years, and it was one of those, I mean, even now they do it every year in newspapers or online. They do a little human interest piece about this little town, you know, Alaska going dark. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, immediately ripping out it was a newspaper at the time, the article, and I wrote vampires in the margin. Mm-hmm. You know, I was immediately like, this is a place vampires go, you know, vampires need to go. And then I carried it around with me for years, pitched it occasionally, never really got a great response. And then it was actually, I pitched it to Ted Adams at IDW.
Yeah.
And Ted was the one that was like, that's a great idea. Let's go with that. And it's funny looking back at it, but Ben and I did it for free at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because IDW was just starting out. I was doing Hellspawn at the time with Todd McFarlane.
Oh, sure.
And I just wanted to write, I wanted to write something of my own. So we did it for free. We did the first issue basically for free. And then the whole thing just exploded, you know, literally in our hands. But yeah, you know, I mean, it was always a combination of two ideas. It was, you know, vampires in Alaska, but it was also that I wanted a certain type of, I wanted scary vampires, you know, when, you know, Buffy was still going on when, you know, we came up with this thing. And it was like, oh my God, they're vampires are dating teenage girls. And it's just, it's getting so far from being scary. They're like our friends.
Right.
So that was one thing Ben and I, you know, the first term we came up with is they have to be like land sharks. It's no romance at all. They do not care about you at all. And I thought that is frightening.
Yeah. The ruthless, the savage of it. But not land shark like Saturday Night Live. Land shark like a shark on land.
That's right. Exactly.
My first land image shark. Is Chevy Chase doing that. And you know, the book is written, the story is written so in such a lean and brisk way. You know, it's pacing is really, really tremendous in that one. Is that something that you seem to take to that pretty quickly? Was that something that you just had sort of intuitively, you think?
Yeah, you know, at the time, it was really funny because I had it written out as a movie pitch, you know, so I had it in three acts. So I just said, let's just do three issues, you know, do an issue per act. And because of that, there's actually a big jump in the story from it ends with them seeing the vampires, the first issue, then the second issue opens and they're already tearing the place apart. I just, you know, I like writing that way because that's the way I like to read. I don't like things too stretched out or over explained or anything like that. So I tend to do a lot of things like that.
It's got it's like a whack when it happens. If you know, there's a sudden jump and you see the consequence of something that you didn't even necessarily see coming, or you know. I'm thinking like The Shining does that, you know, Kubrick does that sometimes. You'll jump to the end of something or into the middle of it. And it makes it like somehow like more of a whipsaw fashion, you know, feeling.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, we went, Wizard Magazine asked us to do a bonus material at the time. And what Ben and I did was we scripted it. We did the attack. So there's additions now that have these additional pages in it. And to tell you the truth, I like the page turn and it's chaos already.
Yeah.
You know, although I have to admit in the movie, the attack scene is one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Yeah.
They do that overhead shot and just chaos is breaking out all over the place. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool. But generally, I like keeping things lean, and I like not treating the audience like they're idiots.
Right.
Which, you know, which happens a lot in horror for some reason. In horror, things get explained away. And that's the thing. You notice there's no scene in 30 Days a Night where they're like, what's a vampire? How do we stop them? We all know.
Right.
We know. Yeah. So.
That's pretty funny to get rid of that conceit. It's funny the way you phrase that too. You know, it's sort of not taking the audience's, you know, sophistication for granted. I mentioned to my son, you remember my son Ben, that you've met through the years at all the conventions. He's now 18 and he's 6'4", which is ridiculous. I told him to stop, like, to slump in my presence. You know, like, come on, I wasn't prepared for this. But I told him you were going to be on, and you know what he said? He said that he always liked you because you, even when he was a kid, you talked to him like he was a grown up.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that you were just saying about your audience in a way. There's something pretty key to not being condescending toward the readers.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That has a lot to do with just the way I was treated as a kid. I hung out with my siblings who were much older than me.
Right.
And so I was always hanging out with adults. I was at adult parties. I was always doing these things. And the people I liked treated me, you know, they didn't talk down to me.
Right.
And I really appreciated that. So it's something that, you know, I've just tried to do as an adult, especially with kids, you know, because I hated that, you know, pat on the head and how are you doing, little boy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It was so condescending. So it's something I really like to do. And, you know, I just did two all ages horror for John Carpenter, John and Sandy Carpenter's company, Storm King.
Oh, wow.
And I had such a blast. I did a werewolf story, you know, and again, I didn't explain werewolves. I didn't do any of this stuff, but I did it for kids. And it didn't change that much of what I did.
Right.
You know? There was a few key things I had to steer away from. And aside from that, I just told a horror story.
It's funny. There was a saying, I think, that was either was Walt Disney or one of the guys that worked for him, but said, you have to make sure it's entertaining enough for adults and smart enough for kids. You know, they've kind of flipped the classic, what you would expect, you know?
Exactly.
Because kids will just say, I don't get it, and just walk away.
Yeah.
Like, you can't mess around with that.
Well, it's like I grew up on the Warner Brothers, you know, cartoons. And those always had layers of stuff. There was always references that I didn't get because they were for adults. But there was a whole ton of stuff I did get.
Yeah.
You know, I always liked the way they did that.
Yeah, it's great to go back and see the ones with the celebrities of that era, too. You know, like those are especially fascinating because some of them are pretty savage. You know, the lampooning is pretty cruel in some of
those. Oh, yeah.
So what's the last horror thing that you've seen from a peer or maybe a newcomer or something that really grabbed you?
You know what? Got to go back to Hereditary.
Yeah.
Film. I was just blown away. Well, first of all, they managed to shock me. You know,
right.
There's one scene that just absolutely, you know, as it happened, it shocked me. Then there's the aftermath that shocked me. And I was just sort of like, oh my God, you know, what is this movie? And I love that it sort of cultivated its own horror. It created its own horror. It wasn't like, well, that's a poltergeist. That's a demon. That's this.
Right.
They came up with their own thing, a twist on the cult and possession and things like that.
Yeah.
And I just, it freaked me out. So that's probably the best thing recently.
Yeah. I feel that way about Mandy, but in a different way. You know, that was like,
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh my goodness. Like it just progressively loses its mind, like visually and in the plot, and all the actors start going crazier and crazier, except Nick Cage, who gets calmer and calmer. And that's what makes it so bizarre. It's like, you know, he's the star, but he's getting like shut down kind of while everybody else is going over the top.
I should check it out.
Yeah,
definitely. I've seen people talk about it. When you were saying that, the sort of descent into madness. Lighthouse. Did you see the Lighthouse?
Yeah, but that's too much like my childhood, so.
Yeah. I don't know why, but we watched Joker and Lighthouse the same night.
Oh, you were feeling good about life and you thought that maybe it was a good time to slam the brakes on that?
Yeah, it was like the Descent into Madness Festival, you know?
Okay, well, let's see. Let's pick a full five films. What else would you have filled out and had like a full film festival for, you know, past the open windows?
God, I don't know.
You got Atonement?
I'd have to.
Or Affliction. Remember Affliction with Nick Nolte? That was like one of the bleakest.
What's that? Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if we're going to talk bleak, then it's Requiem for a Dream, you know?
Sure, sure.
That movie just annihilated me, you know? Yeah. I mean, there's just not anything good about it.
And Garfield.
But, oh, yeah.
Garfield.
So, but, you know, I have been, I need to catch up on my reading for horror comics. I've been so busy writing stuff in the last couple of years. I haven't been really reading. That's why I cited a movie as my favorite horror thing. But there's a lot of cool stuff that I need to check out in comics, actually.
Are you trepidatious because sometimes it might be close to something you were thinking about or it bleeds into something that you were kind of...
No, I don't... Yeah? You know, if... Like, I usually won't read vampire stuff or zombie stuff, but it's more of an overdose thing.
Right, right.
You know? Because even now, people come to me and are like, we've got a great idea, you writing vampires. I'm like, you know, no, I'm done. You know, I think I've done all the vampires I can do right now.
That's great. There's not a sucker born every minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not. As far as, you know, every point in our life, we have a new challenge and a new opportunity, you know, or lots of them. for you as a writer, you were talking about your the work you've been doing. Is there a challenge that you see that you have at this point in your writing life that you didn't have a few years back, one that you're either wrestling with or?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I think it's just coming up with new, fresh ideas, which is always the problem. But, you know, the thing is, when 30 Days a Night sold, or when it hit, I had already been doing comics and writing for about, you know, 10, 15 years, you know, because I had worked for Eclipse and all these companies. Oh. So when that hit, I was like, it was like a permission slip to create. And I just went nuts. I mean, literally, for about 10 years, I was putting out like 3 books a week. I mean, it was just crazy. I was creating so much stuff. Now I've really slowed down.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just, you know, I'm doing, I still have a handful of stuff I'm doing, but I'm not as crazed as I was.
Right.
I'm a lot calmer about the work. So I prefer to like pick something and work it all the way through. As opposed to what I used to do, which it's a comic book thing where you can write 3 first issues of 3 different series and so I would jump around. Now what I like to do is I start a series and I write it all the way through to the end.
Right.
Without jumping around.
Yeah, it's a little more bespoke kind of.
Yeah. You know, I don't have that. Yeah, exactly. You know, I used to be very good at spinning plates. And, you know, now I just, I prefer to just do things one at a time. And actually, you know, that along with, I used to be such a spaz when it came to writing. I didn't do outlines at all.
Right.
I mean, like 30 days, no outline, you know, Dark Days, no outlines, all the Criminal Macabre stuff. I would just sit down and sort of fly by the seat of my pants. Huh. And that was the fun of it.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the fun of it. Now I love outlines. You know, so for like the past 5 years or so, I've been doing detailed outlines because it makes the job of sitting down and writing the actual script so much more fun. Because because it used to just be like, oh my God, what next? What do I do? And, you know, and now I take care of all that ahead of time. It was a bad habit. It was a really bad habit, but.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of something that I saw John Irving say once. He was speaking at a library in Washington, and he said he never starts a book until he knows the last line of the book. The first thing he writes is the last line, and then he gets to it. So, like, and if he doesn't have that, like in World According to Garp, you know, in A World According to Garp, we are all of us terminal cases, or some pretty close line to that. He didn't start writing page one until he had that as his far boundary. And went to it. Like he said, otherwise he would just wander in the desert. So I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. That is. I'm not that detailed oriented, but you know, I definitely won't like to know where it's headed. I like to know where the story lands.
Yeah.
But now, like I said, I work it out in the outline phase. So you know, that makes it a lot easier. You know, I got some good advice from Mark Miller. He was the one who said like, quit jumping around different issues and you know work your way through it. And he was also the one who encouraged more outlines because I would do them every once in a while, but he asked me to write Kick-Ass.
Right, right.
And I was just like, yeah, I'll do it, don't worry. And he's like, could you give me an outline? I was like, oh, okay. So I sort of got used to it and did outlines for him, you know, because I realized it helps other people too, you know,
right.
They can see where the story is going. Especially when you're working in somebody else's sandbox, you know, like I was with Mark stuff. You know.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. The thing about outlines, I guess, is just like any sort of plan like that, it makes you ask yourself questions, and then when you do, you answer them in a certain order. But I kind of like the wandering in the desert that you used to do. That's closer to what my pattern's been through the years. I think I have the same challenge you do. It's harder to meander unless you know where you're going.
Yeah. I used to be able to do it. You know, I guess it's debatable how good the results were all the time. But, you know, some of my favorite stuff was just written kind of like that. You know, all the Criminal Macabre stuff, you know, all that was basically me writing little prose bits of Cal McDonald just talking and then sitting down and just writing a comic and putting in the narration.
Well, and that was my favorite thing about that. And I think that, you know, Criminal Macabre is probably my favorite thing that you've ever done. I just love Cal, and I love the, it's almost like a Raymond Carver short stories, or like reading like Bukowski, except there's pools and really severe supernatural consequences in Los Angeles. But tell me a little bit about your experience with Cal and working on that. When did you start Criminal Macabre?
I started writing Cal McDonald back in the 80s. He was the first character I ever created. And he was in one of the first books I ever did that actually came out through Eclipse. Uh-huh. When he first started, he was a hardcore junkie though. And he wore suits, and I was still playing with him a little bit. And then it's, you know, cause I would just binge on Raymond Chandler. I just love Raymond Chandler, love the voice. It's like a comfort to me. So I was really, that was the toughest part, was coming up with Cal's voice that wasn't imitating Raymond Chandler. Cause at first I was just trying to emulate that.
And it's hard once you fall in that cadence, it's hard to get yourself out of it because it's such a flow, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, adding the drug abuse really helped. He became a little more belligerent than Raymond Chandler would dare, you know?
Yeah.
Cause like, you know, what's the quote about Raymond Chandler? You know, he wrote like a slumming angel. Yeah. The stuff's beautiful.
Yeah,
and
I really
wanted something a little uglier, you know?
Yeah, so a little sloppier. Cal,
sloppier around the edges. And, you know, the stories were a little rougher. I just love that guy. I have tried to come up with other first person voices because I do like writing in first person. Uh-huh. And I can't break out of Cal. I just can't break out of that voice.
It's interesting. So, my favorite voiceovers are the noir, like the Chinatown and the Blade Runner when you pick that one, or, you know, there's something about the going out of it that makes it really tricky. A lot of people can't pull it off, you know, in other, you know, like tonalities.
It's fun. Actually, we just did a new Criminal Macabre series two months ago. We just finished one. And it was like going home. I hadn't written him for about 3 or 4 years, and Dark Horse, you know, has some renewed interest in the series. So I found this wonderful artist in Hungary, and we just started working, and it literally, I didn't know when I sat down. Well, first I outlined it.
What?
I know, it never happened. Very thin outline, but I did outline a little bit. But I had so much fun with the narration and the voice again. Uh-huh. Yeah, he's a lot of fun. You know, he used to be, you know, before I had an audience, I used to write Cal Pro stories and make my, because I used to be in a band.
Oh,
they were my.
We're going to talk about that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, they were my only audience for the longest time, and I really think trying to make that, because they're not comic people, you know, or you know, they're not genre people really. So if I can make them laugh, then I knew I was doing something right, you know.
Oh,
so that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. They are not true believers, so you're gonna have to win them over, even just pay attention, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so the band, you were in a bunch of bands, really. I mean, you were probably 6 or 7 bands, right?
I was in three. I was in three bands total.
I thought you were...
I was in Grey Matter, a band called Elevator, which I only lasted a couple shows with. And then all the solo stuff that me and Jeff do is called Mood Gods. And anything we do that's outside the bands, we do that, you know, we do that way. And actually, right up to when COVID started, I was flying out to DC and meeting the guys, and we were recording new music.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
That'd be
just
great.
Just for fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be a great soundtrack for a Cal McDonald movie.
Thank you. which we're always trying for. You know, I love that about Dark Horse. They never give up on these properties. So we're always trying to get something with Cal going. You know, trying to get a Criminal Macabre show or a movie, something.
If you look at Mike Richardson's track record, I mean, he's been had movie successes long before that company had any yeah. sort of foothold like it does now, you know, with
goes all the way back to Dr. Giggles.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. And barbed wire and then 300 yeah. So many, you know, just Sin City, you know.
Yeah. And now they've got this deal at Netflix. So they've got Umbrella Academy is, I think, you know, got renewed for a second season.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's doing really, really well. For you, if you know, Cal was going to make it on the screen, what would be like the, I won't ask you the casting question because that one's always kind of tough, but what would be the thing that you would want to make sure, if you had one piece of advice to say to whoever was going to be the filmmaker about either the tone or about the character, what would that piece of advice be?
I would say to lean on the horror and let the comedy come out of the horror is a big thing, because I wouldn't want it to be quite as, like, you know, when I think of comedy horror, I automatically think of American Werewolf in London.
Right.
I thought that leaned a little more towards comedy, but the horror was still really good. When they went for the horror, they went for it. So it would be that, not to make, I wouldn't pitch it as a comedy series. I'd picture it as a, you know, a horror series with, you know, with some light moments coming. It's Cal's reaction to the situation that I think is funny.
Yeah.
So it has to be horrible. It has to be horrible and scary. And then he responds appropriately.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's comedy in the sense that, you know, Pulp Fiction, getting adrenaline through the middle of the chest is a comedy scene. Like, of course it is, but of course it's not. You know,
it's also shooting the guy in the back of the car, you know?
Exactly.
While they're talking. I mean, really extreme stuff, but you wind up like, you're like, oh my God, that was kind of funny.
Yeah, no, not just kind of, like super funny. And Cal McDonald should have that kind of, you know, malicious sense of humor to it.
Yeah, Breaking Bad did it all the time too.
Yeah.
They would just push things so over the top that you have to laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you watched that series, but
it's the scene brilliant.
Where a body comes through the ceiling because they didn't use the right, they put acid in the tub. It's just like, it's the worst thing you can possibly imagine, but I was laughing.
Yeah, it's absolutely hysterical, the farce of it. Yeah. And then, you know, looking forward, what are, you know, October Faction, you had the great experience with that, 10 episodes, and what's coming up that you're excited about?
You know, I've been doing a lot of stuff with Sandy Carpenter at Storm King. You know, they've got this label now, and they've been doing comics, and I mean, she's been buying, you know, just about everything I pitch.
Wow.
So I've got like four, I've got two graphic novels, just finished the werewolf series, doing all kinds of different stuff. Plus, I'm basically right now, I'm doing stuff with Clover Press, which is Ted Adams' new thing with him and Robbie Robbins. So I've got a couple books there that I'm very happy with. I just had a series come out called The Grieveling.
Oh yeah.
Which, it's kind of all ages again. With Damien Worm, who I just love working with, you know. We're on, like, I think this is our fourth series now.
Oh wow.
So unfortunately October Faction at Netflix got canceled. They didn't renew it for the second season, which effectively kills the comic too. So Damien and I, you know, but we're just, you know, just create new stuff. I love The Grieveling, and I love working with Clover. So I'm going to do that. Hopefully do some more Criminal Macabre. I've got lots. I've been working with TKO for a while on unannounced properties, projects. Wow. Yeah. So I'm really excited about that. They're really fun to work with. So yeah, I've been juggling a lot of stuff. And actually, the project I'm most excited about, which I haven't talked too much about, was I sat down and I wrote a book about my days playing music.
Really?
Mixed it in with my life. And it's sort of like it's intercut between my life and then my life in music. So it jumps around in time.
Yeah.
But it covers my whole, you know, the whole history with the band and all that stuff. And the best part about it is it's called Swan Street. And the best part is I got Nate Powell doing the art.
Wow.
Who did Mark.
Yeah.
He comes from the same background. He's a punk rock drummer. So he really, it's really nice because he knows the DC scene in the 80s. Yeah. You know, he knows it already. So I sent him a big box of flyers and old pictures and all this stuff. But we're working on that, and it's going to be released through Image.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Like, so, I mean, is it like a high fidelity kind of, you know, kind of over the years kind of epic like that?
I really had fun sort of jumping between. And one of the things it really does is I really track my relationship with Monica, my wife.
Yeah.
Because we've known each other since we're 17.
Wow.
And, you know, we've sort of ventured through life missing each other at all these different points, literally just missing each other. And then, you know, growing up in Washington, D.C., and we wound up meeting again at a party in Burbank.
That's not even a real place.
Yeah. So it's a lot of personal stuff mixed in with the music history, you know, but I get a lot of fun stuff in there. You know, I had to write Ian MacKaye and say, is it okay if I use you in this thing? Cause he was very influential in my life, music life. I mean, he was a good friend, but my very first show I ever played, I had my back to the audience. Like completely, just turned around with my bass, and he came up and physically turned me around on stage. So it's like little anecdotes like that.
That's you know? Great. You have to start with the basics. The audience is that way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
So, yeah, I had horrible, horrible stage fright.
So oh, wow. Wow.
It was comics. It was comics that got rid of it.
Really?
Because I had to do interviews, I had to do panels, you know, all these things that, you know, would have just made me nauseous before. I learned to do it. Actually, pitching movies to blank faces, that'll get rid of your stage fright fast.
Right, right. Yeah. Talk about a tough room.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Well, that's really great. And you know, it's like Gerard Way, like he went into comics. Because I mean, he went into rock and roll because he couldn't get anywhere in comics. He was an intern at DC, and then he couldn't pursue something like Umbrella Academy with DC. So he ended up thinking, "Well, I'll just start a band," and then had like 5 or 6 platinum albums, like showing how hard it is to get in comics.
Yeah, that's amazing, and he's had really good success in comics.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah, good stuff there. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Bernie. The great Bernie Wrightson. You know, I know that for you, it was one of the, probably the crowning joys of your career to this point, your affiliation and association and support of him.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to, you know, I grew up a fan of his. I, you know, his Frankenstein book, you know, I had when I was maybe 12 years old, you know, and just, and his comics and everything. And I just, you know, I idolized the guy. And then what wound up happening was I did a convention in Texas and he was doing the same convention as me. So I got up the nerve and brought over a few of my books and introduced myself. And it turned out we lived one block apart from each other in LA.
At the time?
Like for years. Oh. Yeah. Like we had for a while. And so we immediately just started hanging out. You know, it was just like pizza and beer. We eventually turned it into a Friday night thing where we got pizza, beer, and we played Scrabble.
Wow.
Every Friday.
That's great.
And we would just sit there. And that's how we wrote. We would, you know, we would go off and have little meetings and everything. But basically, we would just sit around laughing.
Yeah.
Come up with these ideas. You know, because the stuff that Bernie and I did, we did, you know, we did 5 books together, 5 series. 3 of them were really light. Like very light. I mean, there were horror and there was gore and action and all that kind of stuff, but they weren't scary or anything like that. Because that kind of just reflected our mood. Mm-hmm. You know, we just would hang out and whatever we found funny would go in the comic, as well as like, you know, every once in a while, Bernie would just go, "I feel like drawing dog size ants." I'm like, okay, I will figure out a way to get that in the story.
That's terrific.
You know? And it was just, you know, it was just, I mean, that's the thing, you know, when we first met, I was so thrilled to be friends with him.
Yeah.
I didn't dare bring up work.
Right.
You know, because I hung around with him enough to see like everybody hit him up for work.
Yeah.
So I never said a word. And after he did, What was that? Oh, he did it with Len. Len Wein and him did a parody of the Swamp Thing for Simpsons Treehouse of Horror.
Yeah.
And that got him back in the comic mood. And that's when he came to me with City of Others.
Right.
And he's like, I wanted, and so we started formulating. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out the way we wanted it to, because all the series that Bernie and I did were supposed to all be in the same city, in the same world.
Like the universe, yeah.
But we got, yeah, but Dark Horse bailed on City of Others, so we wound up doing the other three books at IDW, or the other four books, because, you know, we were very lucky. You know, the last book we did together was the Frankenstein book.
Yeah.
Called Frankenstein Alive, Alive. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic.
I mean,
it's unbelievable.
You know, you can't believe the work in there. I mean, he didn't miss a beat. You know, I've heard people with like, declining talents and things like that, you know. And he, in his 60s, he was as good as he's ever been. So I was really excited about that. And then, of course, you know, he got sick.
Yeah.
And he wasn't able to finish it, but he had penciled the whole thing. So that's when he actually chose Kelly Jones, came in and finished it. So,
which was perfect.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Kelly's, you know, a huge fan of Bernie's.
Sure.
So I was just really glad we got to finish that, because it was such, that was some, he was, you know, that was Bernie's book. That's where we kind of reversed what we do, because usually we would hang out, talk, and I'd run off and write. This, we'd hang out, talk, sketch some stuff out, and then he would actually write captions as he was drawing.
Wow.
And then he'd give it back to, and he'd give it back to me, and I'd work through it a little bit. But this was Frankenstein Alive, Alive was, it was Bernie's baby, yeah. You know, and I was just sort of in one of the, it was an odd position to be in, because I just wanted to stand back and let him do, you know, what he wanted to do. And
yeah.
I think it came out beautifully.
I think so too. And what a great honor for you. And also the fact that it was so genial, and the way that it started was so organic, that it must make it like triply satisfying.
It really is. I miss him so much. I mean, I have more Bernie art than probably any other artist that I collect. I've just got stuff all, I mean, right there on my shoulders, one of his pencil. We were going to do, remember the Jack Davis Frankenstein poster?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Big door-sized one. Yeah. We were going to do one of a Bernie version.
Oh, wow. What would it have been, black and white though, or would it have been color?
Yeah. Yeah. Black and white.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'd be great. How tall would that be? Like life size or death size?
6 foot. Yeah. 6 foot.
He's 6 foot. I figured he was like 8 feet. I don't know why.
Whatever the size of a door is, basically.
Oh yeah. Well, it better be seven feet. Probably, it better be 7 feet around.
Yeah. Probably 7 feet at least. So, yeah, we had, you know, that's the thing. We had so many plans, you know. Frankenstein was supposed to go on for a long time. We also, the one thing we did plan on, we were going to do some scary stuff,
uh-huh.
You know, because all our stuff was just kind of funny and light and all this. So we had planned on, you know, starting to do some really scary ghost stories and things like that. But unfortunately, he got sick, you know, so, you know, he wasn't really able to do much. But, I love the guy. I mean, you know, I moved to Texas. That's why I moved to Texas, was to be with Bernie.
Wow.
Because he moved there first. So we moved there to be down the road from him.
No kidding.
Yeah. And actually his wife, Liz, now lives down the street from us here.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, she moved back from Texas and lives right down the hill from us.
The, you know, you were talking about when you were reading as a kid. And I know for me, like, he was one of those names that just defined that era of comics for me, like in the 70s, you know, I Bernie Wrightson, like along with Neil Adams and, you know, John Buscema and there's certain people that just, you know, John Romita, that era, and nobody looked like Bernie Wrightson's stuff. His stuff looks so different than anyone else's. It was like it's like when you walk, if you sat into a movie theater, and you didn't know what was playing, but it was a Tim Burton or a Tarantino or a Woody Allen movie, you would know within 3 minutes or 2 minutes or 1 minute just by the way it's done. And Bernie was that kind of artist.
You know what was really funny? Because, yeah, I could spot Bernie, especially his faces. I could spot a Bernie face anywhere.
Yeah.
Recently, I've been collecting books that he inked.
Oh, wow.
He inked Sal Buscema. He inked Steve Ditko. He inked Rich Buckler for Batman. And all these books he did. And the thing is, you can almost tell it's Bernie in certain areas, but for the most part, he was just very good at highlighting the artist he was working with.
Isn't that interesting? Like the little accents on the edges of things where you see the inker's personality.
Exactly.
What was that Batman one? Do you remember? Like with the Rich
I can show it to you because I just got it in the mail. Look. So that's Bernie and Rich.
Wow. That's crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I don't have that one.
I just ordered it because I discovered this.
The intricacy of his drawings. I remember as a child that was hypnotic to me. Because you would look at comic book art and you would think, can I do this? And of course the answer would be no, but you would look at his art and you would say, God, would I want to do this? It's like so much work. I mean, that was a trademark that lasted with him for years and years. I always wondered what he was thinking about while he was doing each one of those little lines.
Well, what was really interesting was, you know, because if you look at in Frankenstein Alive, there's a spread of the inside of a library. And there's just books and skulls and dinosaur bones and this and that. Yeah. And Bernie's office, his studio, was shelves of this stuff.
Yeah.
Lab equipment, dinosaurs, skulls, bones, all around. So I think he would just sit there and, you know, glance around and just draw these things. As a matter of fact, there's one where there's a T-Rex, and I completely recognized it as a little model he had on his shelf.
Oh, no kidding.
That's funny. It was really cool.
It was interesting when he would do non-horror stuff. It was interesting because sometimes it just changed the way that you looked at something. Like, you know, even the classic story he did with Swamp Thing and Batman. Like, that Batman's different than any Batman I had seen before that. And that Gotham City was different than any Gotham City I've seen since then.
And, well, wasn't Bernie the first one to really start elongating the ears?
Yeah.
I mean, the cape, I think Neil Adams kind of, you know, got into the flowing cape. But, you know, yeah, Bernie's Batman was excellent.
Yeah.
It's just excellent.
And then The Cult, which was the great series that he did in the 80s, right? Would have been a really, really high point as well.
Yeah. He did The Cult and The Weird.
Yep.
It was like a little tight. And he did a Punisher POV.
Yeah.
I think it was called. Yeah, he did all that stuff. Yeah. No, I mean, just, you know, I think about the guy every day, you know, and, you're definitely right. That was, you know, highlight of my career, of my life, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, this, as you know, this podcast is for heavy metal, and he did some great work for heavy metal in the 70s, and even had part of the film, you know, was his character in the heavy metal movie.
Captain Stir.
Exactly. The amoral captain.
Did he do Freak Show for heavy metal?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a couple pages from that.
Right. Just
beautiful work.
And then I'd be interested in your many conversations with him, when he would talk about the people that blew him away, or like the people that he saw coming up, or talents that he might have collaborated with. Who was the person that he seemed to describe in almost magical terms, or somebody that was
God, he told me so many stories.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he would tell me great stories about spending the day with Richard Corbin.
Wow.
Meeting Steve Ditko and, you know, things like that. Is it Booth? Franklin Booth?
Uh-huh.
I'm really bad with the old illustrators.
Right.
Like he was, but he was very into, you know, a lot of the classical illustrators.
Uh-huh.
But who really influenced him was Graham Ingalls.
Oh, of course.
He loved Graham Ingalls, you know, Ghastly.
Yeah.
From the EC days. And those were a big influence on him. You know, he loved those reprints, and right up to the end, he was getting those big collections. I bought him a couple of those big collections of EC stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, he actually accepted the Hall of Fame Award for Graham Ingalls.
Wow.
At San Diego.
That's amazing. I always imagined that Bernie must have, as a kid, I just imagined that he lived in a mansion in England, and that he dressed like the Hammer movies, and that there was just a lot of axes, like a lot of swinging axes and things like that. But I don't think he grew up that way, did he?
No, couldn't have been a nicer guy. Total working class kind of guy. Like I said, you know, his favorite thing that, you know, we hung out, we had beers,
pizza,
you know, play Scrabble. One time it was really funny when we were in Texas, we both were like, you know what? We're such fans of the classic horror, the Universal horror, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein. So we're like, we need to watch them together. So the first day went really good. We just watched some Hammer horror. Because there's one where we're convinced that he killed a guy.
Because
a guy falls off a balcony and we're like, holy, his neck just looks like it snapped. But we went and we were going to watch Frankenstein together and we both fell asleep. So we're like, sitting here like this. And after the movie, we both woke up. We're like, well, that was worth a try.
That's great. Things that go snore in the night.
Yeah, I know. You know, but we tried because we would just sit around talking about these things endlessly.
Yeah, that's great. So, well, that's great. You know, he was such a master, and you know, and horror comics are really difficult too, because, or at least they're often not executed well. It's an interesting thing because superheroes dominate the medium so much, but you know, you mentioned EC and those classic horror comics, and then, you know, some of the DC stuff up through the 70s as well, House of Mystery and House of Secrets. Had a really distinctive kind of almost Twilight Zone kind of moral parable, twist ending, poetic justice kind of thing. And then, you know, comics didn't really know where to go after that a lot, you know, and you look at the defining horror comics and they've been elusive.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to do, you know, obviously I always wanted to do horror. I was really a big fan of creepy, eerie stories when I grew up. They got away from that morality tale a little bit.
That's true.
And they would just be like little mini movies, little horror movies, little horror. And that really influenced me a lot. Because as much as I love the EC comics, the formula kind of got old really quick.
Yeah, you can, you find yourself predicting it. You know, like, oh, okay, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, this guy's going to pay for it. You know, he's the bad guy. He's going to, you know, it's just a matter of what would they do to him.
Right, right. How would they do it?
Yeah, so you know, a lot of like the Marvel horror, Ghost Rider, Morbius, Son of Satan, they were more superheroes. They lived more in a superhero universe.
Right.
They weren't scary. So that was one of the big challenges when I started out, you know, because the very first books I did was I was adapting Clive Barker into comics. And I learned a lot from that because I was taking short stories that were scary and having to figure out how to do them as comics and keep them scary, you know, and a lot of it was in the artwork. A lot of it was timing. You try, you know, if you can get a reveal on a page turn, you know, then you know, that's the closest you can get to a jump scare in a comic, you know, just have that, whatever happens on the page turn. But I think it's all a matter of atmosphere and, you know, there's a few things you can't do, but, you know, I remember people telling me 30 Days a Night, they thought it was scary.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could, there's no bigger compliment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, because it doesn't show everything. It leaves moments to like your imagination and it's got so many good ideas in it.
And it was very dark. The artwork was very dark. You really had to look at it.
Yeah.
Stuff in there. He really, you know, which I liked it. So yeah. Horror comics, you know, it's very different, you know, than doing superhero stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been writing Kick-Ass for 2 years now for Mark Miller.
Right.
And it's a totally different thing. Wow. Totally different vibe.
Yeah. And with Hit Girl, right? You have Hit Girl coming up in June.
Yeah. I'm doing Kick-Ass versus Hit Girl as my last arc.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Well, yeah, you know, I think the horror comics are definitely a specialized sort of rhythm, and I can't think of anybody that does it better than you. So it's a treat to have you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean it for sure. And just for the Bernie Wrights and stuff, I'm as a someone at a near distance who saw some of that, it was so pleasing to me as a fan to know that he had you as a protege and as a supporter, and even more enjoyable reading the comics.
Yeah, I was really, you know, one of the best things. Who said it? But it just, I don't think Bernie didn't want to do comics for a long time. And he was just doing, a lot of movie drawings, working at animation studios, and he really wasn't enjoying it. So when we got back to doing comics, he just really seemed to enjoy himself again.
That's great.
And that really made it fun, you know? And I think it was, part of it was because of the way we wrote. I mean, you know, getting drunk together and coming up with monster stories, you know, is pretty fun. And then the fact that I did try, he would give me little tips, like I said, about the giant ants.
Right.
Or he's like, make this one goopy, you know, because he's really good at the melting flesh, and, you know, and I, making him happy and enjoy doing comics again really was really something,
yeah.
You know, that really made me happy.
That's beautiful, man. Well, that's fantastic. Well, I can't believe it's been so long since we talked, and what a treat to have you on here.
Thank you so much. I know. Yeah. I think the last time we talked, you were doing a panel where, in Pasadena?
Oh.
With Dan DiDio and Jim? Was Jim Lee on that?
Jim Lee.
And I couldn't make it. Remember, I couldn't make it.
Was it the Watchmen thing, maybe?
Yes.
It was
the Watchmen.
They were going to explain the all the Watchmen sequel stuff beyond
exactly.
Watchmen. Yeah, that was good. So, and so many changes, and so many. So sad lately, you know. I saw that. You know, is it Joe Sinnott, or I don't know how to pronounce his last name?
Yeah, I've always, Joe Sinnott.
Sinnott, because I've always read it, and I didn't know how to actually say it. You know,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, and then of course Danny O'Neill.
I've got some art.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I collect Joe. I try to. I mean, what I can. I have a few pieces of his original art. I just,
wow.
He was my favorite. Yeah, and Danny O'Neill, you know. Yeah. I know. It's we're you know, Joe Sinnott was one of the last of the Silver Age guys.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the Golden Age, it's really, I mean, Steve Ditko was really the last guy that started in the Golden Age, you know.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Well, welcome back to California, and
thank
welcome,
you.
Welcome back to my show. Whatever I'm doing, you'll always be a part of it. So it's good to see you again. And we'll look for the Kick-Ass versus Hit Girl, and we'll look so many other things as well, too. So many things coming out. The horror continues.
Yes. Thank you so much.
All right, man. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
And what a treat it was to hear you guys talk. Steve Niles is just the nicest guy.
He is such a nice guy. Yeah, and it reminded me how much I missed him. So that's nice. Yeah. It was nice to reconnect with Steve, and I'm going to bother him more often.
We should definitely have him on.
Yeah, we should have him on often.
Keep yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, keep him in the crypt, the Mindspace crypt. He'd be great if we did a roundtable. I think
exactly.
He'd be a really great guest for that.
He plays well with others. Yeah, he's very considerate, thoughtful guy, so.
Yeah, it's funny to say that about him because, you know, you guys talked a little bit about how he was in a punk rock band in Washington, D.C. called Gray Matter in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, a band of you know, renown, too. I remember talking to the producer of October Faction, which was the Netflix show mm-hmm. that sadly isn't going to come back, the one that's based on a Steve Niles series. And had a good first season. It's worth checking out. I was talking to the producer of that show for a Deadline story last maybe a year ago, and I mentioned Steve Niles, and he's like, "Dude, do you know what band he was in? Do you know who this guy is?" Like he was like overwhelmed by it. He was it was like if you were talking to Peter Gabriel about a film score and then found out he was in Genesis, or you're talking to Mark Knopfler for a film score and found out he was in Dire Straits. I mean, he approached it with that level of like marvel. He was like really, really impressed by that. So yeah, and Washington was, you know, Steve was part of a scene that was really thriving and roiling scene during the 80s and 90s. Coming up during the Reagan administration, you know, I think is when punk and hip hop in Washington really sort of solidified as a kind of a protest counterculture, anti-authority kind of energy, and then At that time, you got to remember too, is Washington became the capital, the murder capital of the country, had the highest murder rate for years. So the legacy of that and all the things that go with those social ills and had a real impact on the music.
Yeah, definitely. And, mm-hmm. I met comic book Steve. I wish I got to meet punk rock band Steve,
Yeah. That's right. We should get together an all-star band of comic book creators like Gerard Way and with Steve in there. And we find some more people that used to play guitar or synthesizer or something like that.
Oh, we could get maybe Braun in there.
Exactly.
We did the comic book with DC.
Yeah, exactly. Rob Zombie, and there's all kinds of people.
Yeah, definitely. That's very cool. Well, we had a lot of fun talking to Steve today. I look forward to having him back in the future. And another great guest on our Halloween month.
Yeah, exactly. It's all spooky this whole month. Everything's spooky. We got some good stuff coming too.
Yeah, speaking of, do you want to recommend the Essential Shelf for the week?
Oh, let's stick with Steve. We've been talking about his work and there's a lot of good ones. I really liked Freaks of the Heartland, and I really liked obviously 30 Days a Night's a great one, but mm-hmm. I would say for the Essential Shelf I would go with Cal McDonald, who's the lead character of Criminal Macabre, which we talked about during the interview. But it's sort of like taking Dashiell Hammett, who did Maltese Falcon and sort of Sam Spade and that clipped film noir, Private Eye, Gumshoe, that great tradition, and melding it with supernatural monster stuff. So Cal McDonald's like, he's for hire in Los Angeles, got a shady background, he's got a shady future, he's got a shady present, and he's connected to the supernatural world, kind of like John Constantine, Hellblazer, mm-hmm. Over in DC Comics. He has that kind of affinity and influence, but also he's kind of a hard luck case, and it's about him and his best friend who's a ghoul.
Yes. One of my favorite things of the series, Jeff, is how Cal and Moloch, his sidekick ghoul, mm-hmm. Kind of talk to each other. It kind of has almost that the buddy cop feeling, that which some of my favorite movies are Shane Black movies like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys, and so kind of has that same relationship with Moloch.
Absolutely. Yeah. That you're precisely right. It is a terrific aspect of the book. And I love the dialogue, and I love just the Los Angeles that he roams around in. I really love Rockford Files growing up, mm-hmm. which is a great show about kind of a scruffy PI who gets in trouble a lot, gets beat up a lot, and loses the girl a lot, loses the money a lot. He's not that, he's not exactly thriving, but that makes it all the more interesting, and Cal McDonald and Jim Rockford would get along great as long as there weren't any vampires chasing them or something like that.
Yeah, and as long as Cal had his alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, so definitely recommending Criminal Macabre. You can find it on Amazon. You can really find it anywhere. Not very rare, and it's a really great series. I got the omnibus or the volume one, and it came mm-hmm. with I think four or five stories in it. Some drawn by Ben Temple Smith, who I love, who we worked with on 30 Days a Night. Right. So yeah, definitely check that out.
Read it now because it'll be a TV show eventually or a movie.
Oh, definitely.
I can't believe it hasn't happened already, just because it has that. I think the monologue, the Private Eye monologue, would work really good on a screen adaptation of that.
Oh, yeah. I think, speaking of Shane Black, I would love to see what he could do with that property.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be great to see anything from Shane Black.
Yeah. Now, before we go, by the time this episode airs, the last episode of The Boys will be out. We definitely will continue to urge our listeners to check out that series, because I haven't seen the season finale yet, but just based on how the rest of the season has gone, I know it's going to be good.
I can't wait to see it. Exactly. I'd recommend it to people, even if I'd recommend it sight unseen, if only to see what all the fuss is about.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely check out Criminal Macabre, check out The Boys, and continue enjoying this Halloween month.
Yeah, and we'll come back here on Mindspace with more Halloween themed material and guests next week. I'm really excited about it. We've got some spooky stuff on the way.
Yes, definitely. I'm looking forward to it, Jeff. Unless you have anything else, I'll talk to you again next week.
That sounds good. I'll see you back here next week.